Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Thank you very much, Karen, for your kind words, and thank you to King's College for inviting me to give this talk. So basically what I'm going to be doing is I've got the passage that we are going to be discussing, most of which I've left here, and it'll be available for you to read at leisure. But I will speed up and not cover every verse that is given here. More to jump to particular issues that will help me trace a particular argument I want to make. So we are talking about the self in ancient India, in the Indian traditions, and today in particular about a debate in the ancient text, the Mahabharata, which is composed around the start of the Common Era. Now, there's no way of summarizing the context in which this particular debate happens. The Mahabharata is by far the longest pre-modern text. To summarize it is impossible. What I will simply say is that this conversation is between a woman who has renounced the world, called Sulabha, who clearly has extraordinary powers of yoga. And she's talking to a king, Janaka. Now, Janaka is a name that occurs in many different contexts. It's often a placeholder for different elite values, sometimes criticized, sometimes endorsed by the text in which it occurs. The character Sulabha occurs nowhere else except in this dialogue. This dialogue itself is part of a longer lesson that is being given to a king about the nature of rulership. Now, the primary, ostensibly, the larger purpose of that lesson and the use to which this dialogue is put is to make the king consider the balance between the spiritual path of stepping out of the world and forsaking material power in order to pursue truth and self-understanding on the one hand, and performing duty, the royal duties, and being engaged in the world of action. This particular dialectic of being in the world as a form of the good or the correct life and withdrawing from it, especially when one has power, in order to pursue self-understanding, this dialectic informs a lot of the ancient Indian traditions. The Buddha, one of the most striking and best known early cases, was a prince who left his palace and his future rulership of his land in order to wander the world thinking about the nature of suffering and how to alleviate it. There are other aspects of classical, especially Hindu tradition, which query this bifurcation between are you most truly yourself in your self-understanding independently of the world, or are you most truly yourself in this world doing the things that you were born to do, the responsibilities you have taken upon yourself? There are traditions which say that's not necessary. And in fact, later on, in the kind of what we might call the late pre-modern period and the medieval period and so on, especially in dialogue with Islamic traditions, these questions became more complex as well, so that this pure kind of dialectic between being in the world and renouncing it was queried. And even somebody like Mahatma Gandhi, during the freedom struggle for India, deliberately said that there had to be a balance between being in the world for political freedom for a country and being out of it for the sake of spiritual understanding, and therefore there had to be a more complex relationship. So exactly what that relationship is, whether it should be accepted, whether they are two incompatible modes of being, whether they should be joined, this is a 2,500-year-old exploration in the Indian traditions about the nature of what or who one is. So ostensibly, that is the big point about this debate. A woman who is a renouncer and a king who has enormous power and respect in this world. However, the fact is that this renouncer is a woman. And as we will see today through some of the arguments she makes, her being a woman is at the heart of her argument for the position of renouncing the world. And the things the king says about how to be in the world are very much gendered in the sense that it's a masculinist perspective. He is a king. So that this is a conversation between a woman and a man is absolutely knitted into the features of a conversation which is between a renouncer and a king, or a householder, a person in the world. And the most interesting and striking feature of this interwoven conversation is that it allows us to read this text in different ways. There is, on the one hand, this kind of abstract discussion. Who are we truly? How does the self understand itself? In the world, doing the best it can where it finds itself, or does it find itself abstracting itself from the messiness of the world? It's a metaphysical conversation. It's a conversation about the nature of the political reality of power and its transcendence. But at the same time, what Sulabha does is, at crucial points, even when making these arguments, even when presenting why she is arguing for renouncing the world, her being a woman is absolutely at the center of her considerations. So we could also read this as saying something about, historically, we get a perspective on how the personal is the political is the personal, something that was already evident in this text. There is no way in which we can engage systematically in an exploration of the nature of the self and the metaphysics of the self without recognizing we are human beings and we have lived civilizationally in patriarchies in which the very notion of what power is and how it's challenged has been determined and shaped by men. So much as Janaka would like to speak abstractly about the human being, he's talking about a powerful man. And much as Sulabha would like to be this sophisticated philosophical thinker with vast intellectual and spiritual power, she also says there's no escaping the fact she's a woman, and that itself gives her a sense of what freedom is and what she wishes to be free from. There is no disengaging these two aspects. So when we're talking about the self in ancient India here, we're talking about the self that is always situated. So the way the conversation goes is this renouncer, of whom we know nothing except in the frame of this dialogue, which is given as a lesson, this renouncer called Siliba hears about this king who is both powerful in the world, but also is supposed to be of great spiritual character. So she's intrigued. And right from the beginning, the complexity of our bodiliness and the way in which gender informs us is evident in the way the story goes. Casting off her previous form, and we don't know anything about what that previous form was, through her yogic power, she took on another bodily form, flawlessly beautiful. And then, as this beautiful woman, she reached the lovely capital of Mithila, where the king ruled. When the king saw her extreme delicacy and her beauty, he was overcome with amazement. Who is she? Whose is she? That is to say, whose daughter, whose wife? Where has she come from? He said to himself. So, in a way, it is like right from the get-go, Siliba is making a point even before she has spoken. What is the amazement that this king has? How can he be abstracted from the messy realities of gender if the first thing he thinks about is her bodily presence? But yet, remember, he's a king who is committed to the proper forms of courtesy. It's always the case that kings should be patrons of renouncers who have given up the world. So he welcomed her, showed her the best seat, honored by having her feet washed, and had the best food brought as refreshments. And this is another interesting point when we are used to thinking about, especially Western civilizational contexts. Although women renouncers were not in large numbers, right from the very dawn of the textual history we have of India, there were always women renouncers. And they were never questioned about their right to be renouncers, nor indeed were they questioned about their intellectual capacities and spiritual power to be renouncers. So that's a very striking feature within normative patriarchal contexts. The spiritual and intellectual role of women wasn't questioned. It was more the social restrictions that were placed on them. So he treats her exactly in that way as he would if, you know, a middle-aged white sage, your standard sage, had showed up. Pleased by the food, the almsgiving renouncer, seeking renouncer, that is to say Siliba, who depends on other people to give her food because she's a renouncer, amidst men who knew all the learned commentaries on the learned teachings, she challenged the king, who was surrounded by his advisors. She just jumped straight in. Doubting whether he had really gained spiritual freedom in the midst of all his dharmic duties, that is to say, all the duties given by his kingship, by his being a king, by his being a man, by his being of the class and background he had, by the power he has, Siliba used her knowledge of yoga, and there's a very enigmatic phrase, entered his essence with her essence. So the kind of the spiritual mental presence. Just as he was about to address her, she fused the rays of his eyes to the rays of her own too and bound him with the bonds of yoga power. Janaka, the highest of kings, merely smiled, and keeping his thoughts distinct from hers, he received her thoughts with his thoughts. So in a way, this is a kind of extrasensory communication between them. But right from the beginning, she makes these two important moves. She challenges him, and she demonstrates her spiritual power over him. Nevertheless, he is capable enough of being able to talk in that extraordinary state where their thoughts are kept distant and thereby make the conversation possible. Here, the conversation that took place in that one locus, the teacher is telling the student to whom he's talking about this, a conversation between a man who had gained absolute freedom in the midst of the royal parasol and such things, and a woman who had gained absolute freedom with the triple staff of renunciation. Keep that phrase triple staff in mind, because it'll be used again and again to stand in for renunciation. That is to say, all that a renouncer would hold are these three sticks tied together. They own nothing else in the world except the cloth they wear and the bowl they carry for the alms and the stick to help them walk. Now Janaka gives his account of who he is in this extraordinary conversation. I had previously acquired this very distinguished knowledge, and because there was no one else here to set forth on the subject of absolute freedom, learn it from me. So he says, you might have shown yourself to have the spiritual capacity, but I still have the power. So he tries to focus this. I was a most highly honored pupil of the aged Pantishika, etc., etc. Freed of the passion and standing on the highest step, I, one man, live by every part of this. I won't go into what the threefold way means. What he says most of all is, who am I? You think I'm a king? You think I'm embedded in this world? No. After arriving at this highest understanding, I now act in the world with my wrong understanding gone, all my attachments undone. I have no attachment to anything, whether it be something that thwarts me or something that belongs to me. He says, I feel no passion for these things because passions and problems alike deflect one from the goal. My attachments undone, I remain as a king. I'm still a king. I'm unattached, but I still have all the power of the king. Superior to those like you who carry the triple staff, because you have no power in the world. I have the power in the world. You claim to be spiritually free, so am I. So I've got both. I'm both undone of attachment, I'm free, and yet I have the power in the world. You don't have that. So he says, this is the classic argument, of course, that any householder, anybody still in the world carrying on their duties, would say to a renouncer. 50A. Freedom is not just in having nothing, i.e. like you renouncers, but and bondage not just in having things. So don't make the cut between your being superior because you have nothing and you've transcended the world, and I am tied in the world with my things, you know, my court. That's not where the cut lies. Freedom is not between those who have nothing or given up everything and those who have things. I live here amidst all the trappings of kingship, here in the midst of pleasure, wealth, and duty. But understand that I stand in the unbound state, even as I live in the midst of these opportunities for bondage, for being tied up. With the sword of giving up things sharpened on the whetstone of freedom, I have cut the noose that governing a kingdom is, that noose that binds one to the various points of affection. So what he says is, here is the classic view of the powerful man who has it all. It's not enough for Janaka to have all the power in the world as a king. It is to have all the power in the world as a king, and yet also have the power to have transcended it. So that is the culmination of power, to have the power in the world and also to have the power to step above it. Now, think about the implicit fact of the matter. If the supremely realized state is not only to have the spiritual freedom, but also for that spiritual freedom to belong to the one who has material power. Who has material power? How many people in the world have material power? No woman is the king. Nobody who does not belong to the ruling caste or the noble families, royal families can be king. So implicitly what you're saying is that the greatest spiritual achievement is only attainable by a man with extreme privilege. Because imagine how great it is. You never had anything in the first place. If you said, I'm giving it up, big deal. I have all the power and I have given this up. What great freedom this is. But what that means is the greatest freedom comes only to those who have the greatest power. So that's what I meant when I put in at the beginning of this section that this is really about being a man. It's about a masculinist narrative. The spiritual, the true spiritual attainment is really for those who have the greatest material power. And that, of course, is a lesson I think we would see across history in the entire history of human civilization. In all societies, it was the most powerful men who said they had the greatest achievement because they had the most power. Their transcendence of it was the greatest spiritual one. So the challenge to it has always come from those who, because of background, because of gender, for different kinds of reasons, have sought to marginalize that claim and say, or counter-marginalize and say, no, the greatest spiritual attainment comes from those who did not have that material power. So this is actually a quite general experience across the religious traditions of the world, those that have survived and those that have died out in the past, that, and the same thing can be reworked to talk not just about the spiritual, but about the intellectual. To say that first there must be an accretion of social power, and that, of course, in every society has been organized in such a way that a small number of men can have it. And then to say only they become suitably qualified to transcend it, because their transcendence is greater than the transcendence of others who did not have the material power in the first place. So you have a double whammy sense of what it is to be the truest self. Now he makes this argument where, as I said, you could see the interweaving between the supposedly metaphysical debate between householder and renouncer and the gendered one between man and woman. Where have your homeless wanderings taken you, blessed woman? And where will you go? Who are you? And where are you from? Asked the king. I cannot get a clear sense of your learning or your age or of the ethnic group you were born in. So please convey these answers to these matters to this assembly of pious people. You know, I am absolutely free here in the midst of all these objects, my parasol and the like. I want to honor you, for I do think you're worthy of honor. Yeah, you've just shown how spiritually powerful you are, so you could hardly challenge that. Then he goes on, I went and gained freedom. Now, armswoman, some concerns about you occur to me. There is something wrong with your appearance, you know, you're too beautiful, basically. I will speak. Listen to me on this. Your delicacy and your form, your preeminent beauty and your youth, you have all these. And asceticism too. Remember, I have the parasol, I have the wealth, I have the court, and I have spiritual freedom. It's possible. But you can't have your beauty, you can't have your youth and have asceticism too. I wonder. And what you have done does not suit the emblem you display of renunciation. And you've abused my hospitality, my household, my court, and me, just because you wondered, has he gained freedom or not? The triple star for freedom is not for a person who still loves, actually lusts, even if the lust is for one who has gained freedom. Because remember, she did this spiritual maneuver of melding the essence of their intellects with each other. Hear now from my side of it what transgression you commit by resorting to my first enclosure with your being, my bodiliness. Why did you make entrance into my country and then my city? By whose permission did you enter into my heart? As a Brahmin woman, because most renouncers are, they come from the class of intellectuals and priests. You're foremost in social order, while I'm a Kshatriya. I'm from the warrior caste, as all kings are. We two can never join together lest you mix our social orders. You live according to the rules of absolute freedom as a spiritual renouncer, while I live in the religious life pattern of a householding. This second mixing is a grievous offense. I do not know whether you belong to the same line of descent, Gotra, as myself, and you do not know that about me. If you have entered into a man of the same Gotra, that is a third mixing. And if your husband is alive, or even if he has left home for somewhere, it is a fourth kind of mixing of our different lawful obligations. For there is a prescription, one should not go onto another's wife. So your spiritual sort of tie-in with me becomes my sexual responsibility where I should not transgress. You decided upon these wrongs, whether you were ignorant or simply mistaken. Or maybe you're on your own, free of a husband through some fault of your own. If you have any learning, it has all been made useless. And there is a third thing that precludes me my coming into contact with your being. You give every indication of being. Ah, yes, the eternal trope, a wicked woman. There, what has needed to be said has been brought to light. So you have to go. So all of that, 69, when a man and a woman desire each other and each gets the other, that is like nectar. When they do not get each other, or when one feels no passion, i.e. me, then that failure is like poison. You should not touch me. You know what is right. Adhere to the norms of your learned discipline. Your investigation of me, has he gained freedom or not, is done. I've shown you. I'm not interested in you. I take your spiritual merger with me as a sexual attack. I have laid out how, as a king, as a man, as a husband of the royal household, I have laid you out all my duties. And I've therefore shown you, by resisting the temptation of your wickedness, that I am free of these things. Whereas you, the onus is on you. So you could see how you cannot pull apart here this larger argument about what spiritual freedom means, what it is, whether it is possible to be one's truest self while being in the midst of the world of power, from these larger questions about who can say these things, who can be questioned on these things. And clearly that, in this case, sharply agendered matter. Sulaba's response, actually, is she starts from somewhere else. She doesn't first of all say, how dare you say these things about me. She's going to get that. But first she does something very different, and this is a very important thing which I wish we had a little bit more time to talk about. It's in a chapter of my book from 2018 called Human Being, Bodily Being, Phenomenology from Classical India. Because she brings in here something that becomes very important in Western culture at the time of the Enlightenment. The question of whether there is a particular kind of way of doing reasoning, and whether reasoning is something that only men have. And early thinkers like in England especially, like Mary Astor and Mary Wollstonecraft, tried to make the argument that they had as much rights to be like Descartes or Locke, with whom they were often correspondents, and that they had the same intellectual capacity, and therefore to be a woman was both intellectually and politically as legitimate a way of reasoning in this world. And that has always been, of course, a trigger point, and continues to be, of course, in contemporary westernized modernity. What you find here is a lovely inversion. Because what Sulaba does is not the first thing of saying, how dare you speak to me. She gives him a lesson on what reasoning is about. King, a speech is said to have an appropriate meaning to be free of the 18 faults that spoil words or thought and be endowed with the 18 virtues. We don't need to go into the details. A speech has sophistication, careful discrimination, clear order, the presentation of a conclusion, and motivation. Listen to a careful description in terms of sentences, words, the meaning of words, and each one of these items. sophistication and the others that occur over and over again in what I speak. Watch, and you will see that my speech will combine all of these factors to form a single meaning. I am going to tell you the highest truth, King, and I shall speak to you with pertinent meaning and coherence. I will not say too much, nor will I say too little, and I will not speak coarsely, nor unclearly. And then she goes on to give all these, I will not use heavy syllables, I will not speak, and I shall say nothing whatsoever. And this is a very powerful one, verse 90. I shall say nothing whatsoever out of love, anger, fear, greed, desperation, vulgarity, shame, pity, or haughtiness. So she turns it around completely and say, I exemplify pure reasoning, sophistication, clarity, commitment to outcome. All these messy emotions that get in the way of reasoning to who one truly is, I don't have, i.e. you've just displayed it. So in this case, actually, it's turned around and say, yes, on the one hand, you can read it as the renouncer's criticism to be truly clear in your reasoning, to be able to truly reason to self-understanding and freedom from the conditions of life. You have to renounce and argue in this way. But at the same time, it's very, very striking here that it is the woman who gives the lecture on how to be rational to the man, implying what he has just said, apparently in defense of his spiritual power, is full of the emotions. And the tradition, not once do the commentators question this reading or try and cover it up. They absolutely accept that she is right in saying she displays clarity and passionless reasoning. He is the one who is emotional. As far as I know, there has never been a speech in any classical Western tradition that said that. Then she goes on, and I think I'm going to... this needs completely a separate kind of discussion. I don't think we have the time to go through some of the details of it. But when she turns to the question of, King, you ask me, who are you? Whose are you? Where do you come from? Her first move is not to answer him on the terms he's clearly asking about. Which family do you come from? Which is your, you know, class background? Were you married to someone? Not that. She launches instead into this study of the biological construction of gender. She says, how do people come together? How are they created, like lacquer and wood, to form a single entity? So she gives this whole account of ontogenesis to say, she deliberately takes this question, who are you, to say, I'm a human being. You know what a human being is? A human being is the one that has all these different senses and the different capacities. A human being is the one who takes on this form. And she goes on, therefore, to deliberately misunderstand him as asking a question about who are we? When you say who I am, I'm a human being. This is what a human being is. It's got mind, it's got the intellect, it's got this idea of a pure being, it has got the cognitive field. And then she says there are different traditions which say different things. Some talk about aggregation, some talk about appearance. So she goes into this absolutely highfalutin metaphysics of who the self is. So you ask me who I am, you're going to find out. About pleasure and pain, about the sets of opposed pairs, and she gives all these things where the capitalization kind of indicates that these are philosophically very weighty words. These are concepts that were debated from before and after this text was composed for a long time. So anybody reading this would know that this is a manifestation of a very learned scholarship that Sulaba is bringing into this. And then she also gives this ontogenesis of how does the embryo form. And she ends up with saying king of Mithila, this is 118, when the 9 months have been completed, the particular person, the one with name and form, is produced, male or female, according to its sex mark. Once it reaches a child's body, it is no longer thought of in terms of a developed form. All people come into these in this fashion. They come in and they go. So sex is just a particular kind of physical configuration. A human being is what I've told you about. Who is this one? Who is it not? Where does this come from? Where does it not come from? What is the connection between beings and the components that make up this world? These are philosophical questions, King. So I am going to, in a way, pay you the honor of treating your question as if it were a profound philosophical point about who we are. But having said that, she turns around and says, okay, so you said, so she approaches the question as he meant it. Tell me whose family, etc., etc. Why are you even asking this question? Why, 127, why do you ask me who are you and whose are you? Why, King of Mithila, does someone who is freed from the pairs of opposites ask who are you and whose are you and where do you come from? How could you be free that if you're bothered about these things, none of this should matter to you? You should be somebody who should not have descended to the level of asking these questions. So she says at 131, you are not freed, and the conceit you may have in believing you have absolute freedom should be suppressed by your friends, as medicine might be used for someone who is unconscious. She's selling the king, right? She's turned up penniless, she's turned up a renouncer, she's got no power. And yet she says, that's what the king is. You're not. Then she goes on, and I will really quickly cut through this. She says, there is no way in which, this is a clear renouncer's point about the deconstruction of the masculinist power of the king. You can say all you want that you are free, but you're not. Who are you really? You dwell in one city, you stay in one palace, you have one bed at night, half of it belongs to your wife. The king is always dependent on others. He's never in control. You think you have power? No. All the time, you're at the mercy of everybody else around you. You're not in charge. As she says in 142, the king is not in charge. Others are always telling him what to do. Bathe, take hold, drink, eat, pour the offering, worship the sacrifice, speak, listen. Every man is a king in his own house. Every man is a household, is a head of household in his own house. He is also a king. Sons, wives, and likewise his own self. They are all common to everyone. So he says, everything that you take to be unique are simply the structures of society. You're beset by the same kinds of things, desire, aversion, kindnesses. How are you different? You're engaged in the world, you have a great deal of power in it, but if you deconstruct how you are, this is what it comes down to. Then she turns to who she is. I have no attachment to my body. How could I be attached to another's? So, mind you, she is being a bit disingenuous. We don't really understand. Why did she take on the beautiful form, whoever she was, except as a spiritual lesson, perhaps, to the king? But in any case, the capacity to change her body through yogic power, so she has no attachment to her own body. And yet, of course, it's a woman's body. So one of the very interesting things is, if she had the capacity to change herself, she could have turned up as an animal. There are speaking animals, wise animals in the Mahabharata. She could have turned up as your standard issue, you know, white-bearded male sage. But she stayed as a woman, and a beautiful woman. So that makes me want to say that this text is saying something about the centrality of gender to the spiritual argument about who we are supposed to be. King, if you stand there, freed of your attachments, how is it you have come once again to be attached to such things as your parasol, your kingship? If you're completely free, what wrong did I do when I made entry into you with my own being? There is a special stricture in the rules of ascetics. They must dwell in an empty house. What violation did I commit and to whom when I came to stay in this empty house? If you're truly free, this body is just a body for you. So you shouldn't be, oh, what did you try to do to me, etc. You're a wicked woman, nothing. This is an empty house. I have come to dwell in this empty house. The very fact that you ask those questions shows you're not free. So you should not talk like this of a man, such a thing as in public as a man joining a woman. I am going to dwell here in you, King of Mithila, without touching you, as a drop of water on a lotus leaf stands on a leaf without touching it. Or if you do sense some touch of me, though I do not touch you, how is it then that the knowledge transmitted to you by that mendicant teacher of yours is seedless? And then she goes on to argue, but she doesn't argue, she just points out, actually, I'll come to tell you who I am after I have devastated the foundation of your argument behind your questioning. I'll still tell you about the questions. 181, I'm not higher in order in class than you by birth, nor am I a lower sort of woman. I'm the same order as you, a woman of clean birth and chaste. There was a seer who was a king called Pradhana. Obviously, you have heard of him. Understand that I came to be in his family and I'm named Sulabha. In that clan was I born. Since there was no husband suitable for me, I was trained in the rules of gaining absolute freedom. So all alone, I live according to the hermit way of life. I'm not concealed in a disguise. So the implication is that she is actually the young, beautiful woman that he sees. I do not confuse what is another's with what is mine. I'm not creating a mixture of lawful norms. I am firm in the practices of my own duty. I do not waver in my promises. I do not speak without careful examination, nor have I come into your presence without careful examination, O Lord of men. As a mendicant might dwell for one night in an empty house in a city, so I will spend this night in this body of yours. I have been honored by your giving me a seat, by the hospitality of your words. Having slept well and sheltered, I will go on the morrow. After he had heard these reasoned and significant statements, the king did not say anything further. So I'm tempted to, in fact, just leave it at that point, because nothing is more powerful than that culminating argument. And I hope that, you know, this text is something that is read much more widely and debated much more widely in the context of issues about the nature of power, the nature of the spirit, the nature of the self in the world in the past and in the world today, and how the situatedness of our gender informs all of our philosophical questions about who we are. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.